Accession number 14589, reel 3.
Brigadier Smith, reel 3. How did you meet Templar yourself?
Well, I met him once or twice when he came round. He used to travel round in an armoured car. That may seem a funny way for a High Commissioner and Supreme Commander to travel, but his predecessor, Sir Henry Gurney, had been killed in a road ambush on his way up to Fraser's Hill, travelling in a large Daimler with flag flying. And, of course, that was a considerable blow to British prestige and helped the communist terrorist morale no end. And Templar was determined that they weren't going to do that twice, and very sensibly came round visiting people in his armoured car. He was the sort of man that when he peered at you with his eyes, you almost stood to attention, even if you weren't standing to attention. But he had a good sense of humour, and he always went straight to the point. The reason that I managed to carry on serving in the Gurkhas after my helicopter crash in 1964, one of the reasons was the fact that the honorary colonel of our regiment then was General Templar. And right from the beginning, when I was nearer death than life, he took a great interest in me, although I was in Singapore and he was in England. And he was, once he realized I was determined to continue serving, he did his really all his effort was devoted to making that come about, if that was my wish. So I'm a great Templar fan.
What was the attitude of the Gurkhas towards the guerrillas?
I think those who'd seen what the guerrillas had done to the local population at the beginning, there were a lot of atrocities carried out by these communist terrorists against innocent people, so they didn't forget that, and so they realised that if Malaya was ever going to enjoy peace and freedom again, we had to get rid of them. So yes, they were fully determined and there was great rivalry between each Gurkha battalion as to how many contacts they'd had and how many kills they'd achieved. This aspect was never publicised too much because it would look bad in the press, but each battalion was very keen on beating the others and the number of exterminations they'd managed to achieve.
How did the Gurkhas like operating in the jungle?
Oh, they were absolutely adept at it. They were incredibly good at it, far better than the average British soldier or British officer. They have because they basically, then anyway, were from a rural community, they could, their sense of direction and the speed they moved at was always good. They have the ability and had the ability to carry big weights because they, in their own homes and villages and the mountains, even as children, they had to carry weights. So carrying 60, 70 pounds of what was on their back for a few days meant nothing to them at all. We had to get used to it, but they seemed to take it right from the beginning. They had a great sense of direction, as I mentioned before, and their knowledge of the jungle was considerable.
Now, Borneo in 63-64, when you were with the 1st 7th, can you tell me how you went there, please?
I was actually transferred from the 2nd 7th to the 1st 7th as second in command, and having joined them in Ypres in North Malaya, we moved to Borneo about a month or two later. We went to the 3rd Division of Borneo, which is the capital of Cebu. In those days there were very few roads indeed, mainly transportation was mainly by river, the River Rejang and tributaries, or else by helicopter to landing zones that had to be hacked out anyway. So we were given a huge area to look after, and the only reason we were able to look after it was the fact that we had the 845 Naval Air Squadron of helicopters, Wessex helicopters, who were stationed literally on our doorstep at the aerodrome at Cebu. So covering that large distance, making sure there were no infiltration from across the border of Indonesia and Kalimantan, very much depended on the cooperation of the helicopter squadron. And we had great cooperation with them. We met them every day, and without their aid we could never achieve what we did.
What kind of actions did you have against the Indonesians?
Well, expert, we didn't have many while we were there. I think the fact that we were had bases on the likely routes into Kalimantan. The only way you could get into Kalimantan, from Kalimantan across into 3rd Division, was following rivers, courses. The country was almost impenetrable. So by putting bases on those rivers and making sure that it was known that there were bases there, undoubtedly stopped the Indonesians coming that way. A group did get in, but they came in by sea up the Rejang. And one of our companies, A Company, and a chap called Dennis O'Leary, had fought a fierce little action on an island, which was slimy and full of mud and swamp and everything else. And during that action, I think one or two Gurkhas were wounded, but not badly. And in the end, the whole party of infiltrators were captured. But that was the only direct action we had as a battalion while I was there. I actually had my helicopter crash in April 1964, and of course didn't come back. I never went back to the 1st 7th again, apart to say goodbye in July of that year.
April 64?
64, yes.
Can you tell me what happened in the crash?
Well, it's just in my book. However, yes, I was commanding the battalion then, because the CO was actually in England on a course, and I was officiating commanding. One of our companies was operating on the border with Kalimantan under command of another Gurkha battalion. And they apparently achieved very little, and I wanted them back under my command because we did have information coming in. And I agreed with the CO of the 2nd 10th Gurkhas, who was commanding that, who had that company on command, to meet him at B Company's location near the border. So he flew in from Semangang and I flew in from Cebu. The day we went to fly in was the day that my colonel came back from England. And I met him at the airport and I told him that the helicopter laid on. But he quite rightly said, well, you've been running the operation for the last week or two. I don't think about it. You go in and I'll catch up on all the bum from the office, which, was, as it turned out, was a very wise decision on his part. Fortunately for me, there was a spare seat in the helicopter, and I persuaded the doctor, our regimental doctor, to come in with me. This company had been in jungle for about 2 weeks, and I thought we could take out any men who were sick or he felt wanted to come out for health reasons. So we set off with 8 reinforcements of Gurkhas, the doctor and myself, in this helicopter. We couldn't find the landing zone for quite a long time, and eventually we found it was on the top of a ridge, very steep on both sides, and the Gurkha company had cut down the trees at the top and made a log platform, and it was sheer on both sides. It was a difficult place to land in, but then these naval helicopters were landing in more difficult places than that. They were marvellous pilots. Anyway, we were hovering over the landing wood, the log platform, being marshalled down by the Gurkha Sahib major on the ground, when one, for some reason or other, the engine seemed to cut and we dropped like a stone. Unfortunately, one of the wheels was over the edge and we turned over and rolled over twice or two or three times down. We would have gone into the river below, which is about 200 or 300 feet below, but we hit a tree stump which stopped us going any further, but we were upside down. Unfortunately, the guy sitting where the tree stump came in was me, so I found myself pinned by my arm, the helicopter upside down in the jungle, dark, and there was silence, and I just assumed that everyone else had been killed. As it transpired, the doctor was the hero of the day. He'd managed to get most of the men out, and they'd all run away with the crew because they thought the thing was going to go up in flames, which it should have done in theory. The pilot had released the fuel as he turned over, which was a wise thing to do, but it was all, I was doused in it. And I was hanging in the darkness on my, with my left arm and my right arm trapped. Then when they counted heads, they realised there was one guy missing, me. And the doctor came back, although they tried to persuade him not to, because they felt the thing was very dangerous, and saw my plight and got me out and got the George Medal and became Major General Patrick Crawford, RAMC, and he only retired last year.
How did the Indonesians compare as an enemy with the communists in Malaya?
Oh, well, they went through two periods. At the beginning, they were irregulars who had been trained by the Indian Eastern Army, and they were some from Borneo itself, there were some Chinese, there were some discontents from elsewhere, and they tended to be fairly indifferent. But then after 1964, the period I'm mentioning, the Indian Eastern Army itself got far more engaged in it, and some of the regular units fought extremely well, particularly in the 5th Division and 4th Division. Their tactics were not always good, but if they were cornered, they fought hard, and they used their mortars particularly quickly and well. Although I never had the, thank goodness, opportunity to fight them, I know, talking to friends and other Gurkha towns, that they were quite a tough opponent, even though they weren't particularly well led, and their own administration was pretty abysmal. They had helicopters given them by Russia on the other side of the border, but they never maintained them, so that during the confrontation it was very rare indeed if you saw a Indian Eastern helicopter flying on the other side of the border, because they were grounded, lack of spares or maintenance. So their administration in the forward areas was very poor indeed, and I think this contributed in the end to their defeat.
Can we just go back to the period when you said you had your happiest time as a bachelor, when you were doing that recruiting work in Nepal in 48-50? Why was that so good for you?
Well, it was an extremely interesting job. We were working very hard because we had to try and recruit Gurkhas, a lot of Gurkhas, very quickly. It was a delightful place in those days. Darjeeling was it's now very run down, but then it was still the centre of the tea industry, and on the plantations were British managers and assistant managers. Many of them had been with Gurkha towns during the war. So with a lot of friends, I was then, because I had two arms and two fit legs, a keen climber. There were plenty of opportunities around to get into Sikkim. We weren't allowed into Nepal then, but we were allowed to walk along the border in Nepal. I was a keen games player. There were plenty of chances to play games. Worked hard and we played hard, and Darjeeling itself was a wonderful place to be in. Now, unfortunately, it's very run down, the little communism on the tea estates, etc., and it's a shadow of what it was like then. There was a lot of social life then, I played cricket for the Planters, and they were a fairly good side. So, yes, it was an ideal station for a bachelor in those days.
What was the method of recruiting Gurkhas then?
In those days, of course, we couldn't go into Nepal. Our recruiting depots were on Indian soil, even after India got independence. So we had to send ex-soldiers as recruiters into the Nepal, into their own particular areas, villages, instructed on how many recruits to bring back, when to bring them back. And they would bring their recruits back. Those that passed, they would be given a reward for, depending on how good the recruits were. Those that failed, they had to go back to their villages, and the recruiter, of course, was given an allowance to get them back. It was terrific competition for then. Of course, there were quite a lot of vacancies in the Brigade of Gurkhas. But even then, there was a lot of competition, and many young men came in, were failed, who perhaps in the Second World War we would have accepted quite happily, but we didn't need that number then, of course, so we could be fairly selective.
What type of things might fail them?
Well, there were minimum height, minimum weight, and certain medical things that had to be correct for a start. We tended then, and I stress the word then, we tended then to go for the pure hill recruit, the man who had lived in the village all his life and his father lived in the village all his life, because we felt at the time they were the best material. The British Army, which we were becoming part of, didn't at that time insist on the Gurkhas' education being as high as it is today. So for service in Malaya, where ability to walk in the jungle, toughness, endurance, etc., they had all those qualities, and that was all that was really required then. Now, of course, being part of the British Army with technology and different types of weapons, you need a different type of Gurkha soldier.
Do you remember the impression you got about how the men you sent in would go about their work once they got there? Who they would contact?
You mean the recruiters?
Yes.
Well, the recruiters were all ex-soldiers, so and they only were recruited in their own particular village area, so there was no question of them going beyond that. And they weren't all good, the recruiters. Some of them, of course, brought in rubbish, and we had to sack. One or two of the unscrupulous ones would get hold of young Gurkhas in Darjeeling Bazaar and put them into hill costume, brief them on where they lived in the village in Nepal, and then hope they'd get them through that way. But we became fairly adept at finding them out in the end. So it became much more professional later on. 4 or 5 years later, of course, we set up recruiting depots actually on Nepalese soil, which made life much easier.
What were your methods of sorting out the ones who'd recruited in the Darjeeling Bazaar? How did you do that?
Oh, we just sent them off. We didn't recruit them.
No, but how did you find out that that had been the case?
Oh, I see. Well, our Gurkha officers usually asked them questions about their villages and what the name of the river was by there, and was the headman still alive? Where was his nephew? And that was usually the way we caught them out. I expect the odd one slipped through, but it wasn't very easy for them to do so.
Do you think any of those from the Darjeeling Bazaar might have been all right if they had?
Well, we did take some deliberately from Darjeeling, and those were usually for jobs like clerks in those days because they had better education. And those, that was done deliberately. We did have a percentage possibly for signals and things like that. But the whole thing changed once Nepal, in Nepal, education became much more recognised in the villages even. And now, of course, we insist on a higher standard of education. Very different.